This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the COVID-19 vaccine being mandated at institutions like IU Health. And with us now is Brandon Smith, Statehouse reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, what has it been like covering this debate? Let's start with just what is going on.
Sure. You have an interesting mix of what's going on with vaccine mandates, because it's a real push and pull between what the private sector and private companies are choosing to do, and then what the public sector and particularly what we've seen so far is public universities trying to do. And there's been a lot of focus on, there's been some attention paid to what the private sector is doing, certainly, but I think there's been a lot more controversy around what the public sector is doing. And that plays into sort of the role of government and what's legal and what's not and things like that. So it's kind of like two spheres almost, even though we're talking about fundamentally the same issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what's been the most surprising thing you've seen while covering this issue?
I would have to say, I was thinking a lot about this question, and I think the most surprising thing to me through all of this, and this debate really goes back months, because, you know, the vaccine has been around since very late in 2020. And so we had the whole Indiana legislative session from January through April. And the thing that shocks me the most is that the General Assembly didn't weigh in more concretely on the question of can you or can you not mandate the COVID-19 vaccine. They only, at the very last moment in session, and I mean literally like the language had never been debated and it was put into a bill on the second to last day and last day of the session. So literally at the last possible second in the General Assembly session, they put in a language into a bill about vaccine passports, but it doesn't specifically say anything about mandating the vaccine. Mm-hmm. At least as a public entity, and it doesn't say anything about the private sector, whether through mandates or the vaccine passports. And so the fact that the General Assembly, this particular General Assembly, which is very conservative, the fact that they didn't weigh in legislatively in a more concrete way was, I think, the most surprising thing to me.
Well, that's interesting. It's as if maybe they are aware that there could be some mandates coming, and maybe they don't want to be so specific.
I think certainly when it comes to the private sector, I think that's true. You know, they err on the side of we're going to let private businesses do whatever they want, whenever they want, on a variety of issues. And mm-hmm. So I think that was probably driving some of it. If they had passed a bill or if they were debating language that would have restricted what private businesses could do, I think that would have created a lot of pushback from the private sector in Indiana, which are, you know, some of which are very powerful, some of these private businesses in the General Assembly. So I think that was probably part of that, is they wanted to avoid getting into that at all. But again, like, I'm pretty shocked, given the reaction we've seen after, for instance, Indiana University announced their vaccine mandate. Mm-hmm. After that, and the reaction we saw from a lot of legislators, I'm surprised that there wasn't a bigger push in session to go, mm-hmm. we need to allow this or not allow this, really.
Right, right. Well, speaking of Indiana University, from my understanding, they said they were going to mandate it, but then they kind of changed that a little bit.
A little bit. It's so what they announced was, you know, when students, faculty, and staff come back for the fall term, either you have to get the vaccine, with limited religious and medical exceptions, which exist in current law for a lot of, both at the federal level and at the state level, for a lot of vaccines. So universities and schools already require vaccines for principally students more than faculty and staff, but they already require a host of vaccines. And there are already exemptions built into the law for religious and medical reasons. So they input this vaccine requirement and said, you know, if you don't, you know, first of all, if you do apply, for, you know, if you do fall under one of these exceptions, you're going to have to be tested regularly. But if you don't fall under one of these exceptions and you don't get the vaccine, you don't get to come back. You're fired mm-hmm. or you're expelled, kind of thing. And that was a lot of people thought pretty harsh. Mm-hmm. But importantly, they also set up a system by which you would have to prove you had gotten the vaccine. And of course, we have those vaccine cards. Those of us who've gotten the vaccine, you get those cards. It's pretty easy to show that proof. But Indiana University was requiring that proof. That is what kind of ran counter to, potentially, Indiana law. So the law that I referenced that the General Assembly did pass having to do with vaccine passports. So what that law said specifically was no government entity in the state of Indiana could require or mandate a vaccine passport for COVID-19, only COVID-19. And they defined that passport as showing proof or asking for proof of vaccination. And so Indiana University comes out with this mandate and it says we're going to require proof. And lawmakers, Republican lawmakers specifically, not all of them, but a lot of them, a lot of Republican lawmakers in the state, the Indiana Attorney General, Republican Todd Rokita, private conservative groups come out and say, whoa, you can't do this. You're a public entity. And that new law prohibits you from asking for proof. Now, that is an unresolved question because there's some debate as to whether or not Indiana University is a public entity or is a government entity as defined in this law, because the law isn't really written very specifically as to that sort of question.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, some lawmakers, including legislative leaders, at the end of session, when we asked that question, does this apply to schools and universities, said, no, it doesn't. But Indiana University backed down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They said, we're going to mandate the vaccine, but we're going to not require you to show proof. So it's sort of the honor system a little bit. So it's all, you know, or as I've been making the comparison, it's like having a mask mandate with no enforcement, as Indiana saw. You know, does it still count as a mandate?
Mm-hmm. Well, then how does IU Health fit into all of this? Is it part of the same system or is it separate? Because that's the debate I've been hearing, is that there is a vaccine mandate in that area.
There is absolutely for IU Health, but IU Health is private. I don't think anybody is trying to make the argument that IU Health, yes, it has the IU name, but it is a private entity in the way that Indiana University is undoubtedly not.
Mm-hmm.
Is the argument that I've seen. So I think there's less of I haven't really seen pushback from government leaders saying, whoa, this new law says you can't do this or that to IU Health, because I think that's considered a private business. And so, again, that's where we have this kind of split between, you know, there are two vaccine mandates, both involving entities that include, you know, IU, but one is clearly public, one is not. And so you have this kind of, yes, there's still angst and consternation over mandates in both places, but you have sort of the government or government leaders saying, whoa, now to one of them over the other.
Right. Well, as far as the debate is going, has it become politicized? Is it like one side over the other, or is it pretty much just a personal preference?
No, it's absolutely politicized the way almost everything with COVID has been. A lot of attention seems to be focused from those who are criticizing these mandates on the fact that so far the COVID-19 vaccines from any one of the companies that provides it are under emergency use authorization from the FDA and not full approval. Now, there is an expectation that full approval is coming, perhaps even in the relatively near future. So we could theorize then that once there is full approval, maybe that some of this opposition goes away. I personally don't think that that's true, because I don't think this is really about an EUA or full approval. This is about COVID itself has become politicized. And there are some people who simply don't think the government should be able to mandate anything around COVID. And there are some people who think, well, it's a vaccine like we mandate these other vaccines. So, we'll see if the debate changes. If and when the FDA gives full approval to these vaccines, but I personally am a little skeptical of that.
Mm. Well, what about the other universities across the state? Are you seeing any of them talking about COVID-19 requirement for the vaccine to be required?
Yeah. So again, this is an important split between public and private, right? So Notre Dame University, very much a private institution, is requiring the vaccine, faculty, students, and staff. I'm sure there are probably some, you know, some groups up there who are unhappy about it. We haven't seen the same level of protests or outrage over it. We haven't seen letters being written from, half of the Indiana Senate and a host of people in the Indiana House. We haven't seen the Attorney General weigh in on Notre Dame because private institution, they get to do what they want. We see Purdue, though, even before sort of IU did its full mandate and then backed off a little bit, Purdue never went all the way to mandate. It's being strongly encouraged. They are incentivizing folks to get the vaccine, which IU is now doing as well, with things like, you know, a full year's tuition or for, you know, faculty and staff, it's prizes and things like that. So Purdue never went all the way there. But again, importantly, we see, which is go back to my original point, there is this split between what private groups can do and what public groups can, for lack of a better term, get away with.
Mm-hmm. And what about the protests that happened earlier this month in response to the vaccine requirements at IU Health and Indiana University? Was that unusual to see those types of protests, or do you think we're going to see more?
I think it's a little unusual about a private company. I think if more companies decide to start allowing this, I don't think you'll see a whole host of protests over it for the most part. But again, IU Health, while private, because it has that IU name, it gets a little, you know, sort of fungible, or, you know, not fungible, but, you know, a little sticky mm-hmm. there. But I think that it's unsurprising that we saw a fairly significant protest, about 100 people or more, at Indiana University down in Bloomington. I expect if Indiana keeps its current course, which is requiring the vaccine, even though you can't require proof, I expect there might be another one. There's certainly this group out there being backed by or at least involved with a prominent conservative attorney, Jim Bopp, who's threatening to sue IU over this mandate because he thinks it violates the Constitution, despite the fact that IU requires other vaccines. So I'm not sure what his argument is, but if he files that lawsuit on behalf of this group, you could see that group or affiliated organizations probably protesting again for the attention and on the issue. But again, I think you really have to divide this debate in a lot of ways between that public and private split.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. Brandon Smith is the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. After the break, we'll talk more about vaccine mandates and the pros and cons of having them. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The debate around vaccination mandates, particularly for healthcare workers, is what we're talking about today. Now we're going to look more into the pros and cons of having a vaccine mandate. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store, send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. With us to talk about the pros and cons of a vaccine mandate is Aaron Reynolds, Associate Professor of Health Services at the University of Southern Indiana. Welcome, Aaron. It's great to have you back again. I want to ask you about these vaccine mandates. Is this common for healthcare workers?
Well, thanks for having me. And there are for healthcare workers in particular, it depends on the hospital system that they work in. And so we, as a country, do have vaccine mandates, but most of us would be more familiar with the early school vaccines. So, you know, you have to have your measles vaccination or your tetanus vaccination to be part of a daycare situation or to enter kindergarten. And so when we look at kind of adult situations where you're moving into the workplace, then those mandates are really specific to the area that you work in and whether or not it is necessary to keep either the employees themselves healthy or the populations that they work with. And so hospitals fall into that kind of both sides of that. You know, you could be exposed to COVID from your patients, But we also don't want patients being exposed to COVID by employers or employees.
Right, so right.
When we look at hospitals, long-term care facilities, who work with vulnerable populations, we're more likely to see vaccination mandates at those particular places.
So would you say, I mean, is that what makes this sort of vaccine mandate different, the COVID-19 vaccine mandate versus any other sort of vaccination requirement?
Not necessarily. I think more what I'm seeing with the vaccine mandates is, you know, if large corporations like Amazon or Target or Walmart start requiring their employees to get vaccinated, that would be where this differs a little bit. And so, you know, when you look at hospital systems, you know, I'm trying to think back to the last time I worked in a hospital, but I think I had to have my Hep B up to date. I had to prove that I'm old enough that I actually had chickenpox as a child. So I had to prove that I was immune to chickenpox. And so I did have to submit vaccination history as a condition of my employment at a hospital. And that was to protect me as working in that hospital, but also to protect the people that I was working with.
Right, right. And it's interesting to me because I'm kind of trying to understand the arguments for folks who are against these mandates, especially in healthcare settings, when I think that is the basis for a lot of employment. You can get an exemption, but in general, like, for example, the flu vaccine, I know my husband worked in healthcare and he had to get the flu vaccine every year.
Correct. And so, you know, when we look at, you know, the exemptions, we get into a very gray area because it's state to state. And so you can get different types of exemptions allowed. All states offer a medical exemption, right? Because not everybody can get vaccinated.
Right.
And that's specific to the type of vaccine that you're looking at. But all states are going to have a medical mandate. But the religious and personal belief exemptions are going to be different state to state. And California is a great example of this because they used to have pretty loose exemption rules. So there was a huge category of personal belief exemptions that were allowed. And this was more towards the measles vaccine where it became an issue. But after having a measles outbreak, one of the largest in the United States in 20 years, they actually pulled back on their religious and personal belief exemptions in order to require more of those. And this is childhood vaccines. And so, you know, different states have handled exemptions differently. And so, you know, you get it's such a cloudy area because you've got, you know, the federal government doesn't mandate vaccines. States can, local municipalities can, but they typically don't. But personal businesses, private businesses, those are a different kind of area. And so, you know, schools, states can mandate certain vaccines for schools. But like the previous commenter said, we don't typically get into that with private entities. Mm-hmm. And so what we can and cannot mandate for private companies is all going to come down to what the law allows and how it's written. And you get your Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, your Americans with Disabilities Act, those get involved.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, if there's the ability to get an exemption, I guess I'm still trying to understand why people are not happy about someone saying you have to have your vaccine when it's like, but there is also leeway.
I think part of it is coming down to the politics around COVID and COVID vaccinations. And, you know, people don't like being told what to do. It's a little different when you're a child and you're not, you know, you're 5 years old and your mom or your dad takes you to get a vaccine. And it's not like you can really say, like, I don't want that. but, you know, when you're an adult in the workplace and somebody's telling you, you have to do this or you have to do that, it gets into that individual freedom category where people just don't like being told what to do or they feel like it's infringing on their abilities to make decisions about their health. And so that can be where some of this is coming from, is that personal choice basket of things.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's any correlation between folks who refuse to wear a mask and don't want to get vaccinated. I wonder if there's something similar there.
I don't think the data is there yet, but I think we can all correlate some of that in our minds. You know, that people who didn't want to wear masks may not have felt COVID was all that serious. And that may also transfer to their maybe not wanting to get the vaccine because, again, they didn't ever think that COVID was all that serious. There's other reasons that people don't get the vaccine. There's, you know, doubts about the safety. There's concerns about the emergency authorization that it's working under.
Mm-hmm.
So people do have a lot of opinions on this. Part of the problem with some of the safety information is that there's a lot of misinformation about the safety out there.
Right, right. And I think that that just continues with social media and different things. Everyone has a platform now. But what are the pros, for example, of having a vaccine mandate for employees? What would be the pros for that?
Well, obviously herd immunity. And I know we've heard a lot about herd immunity over the last 15 months. It's something that I teach in my epidemiology classes. And I think I might have to change my extra credit question here in the coming semesters, because everybody knows what it is now. It's not a really hard question on the exam anymore. But when we look at requiring high rates of vaccination to reach herd immunity, those mandates really do push us to that herd immunity rate, which for some diseases like pertussis, we need to be in the low to mid 90% range to get herd immunity. Measles, most of our childhood vaccinations, we needed kind of high 80s, low 90s to reach herd immunity. And the only way to get that was through a mandate. Now they're projecting, you know, a lower herd immunity rate for COVID-19, but they're still kind of trying to even work on whether or not, you know, it's more around 50% or is it more around 80%? They've kind of settled on 70%, but it's going to be a while before we actually have the full data to determine what herd immunity rates are.
Right, right. Well, what would be the cons of having a vaccine mandated? Are there any cons to that?
Towards the
COVID-19 vaccine.
So one of the things that I've kind of been thinking about in this kind of personal choice versus community good, and when you look at kind of public health in general, we tend to, I was taught it as a pendulum. And so we kind of swing between laws or mandates that support personal choice, and then we swing towards things that are more for a community good. And we've been swinging towards personal choice for a long time. And so a lot of our rules, a lot of our mandates heavily consider a person's personal choice. And if you had to decide one way or the other, they typically do come down on the personal choice side of things. But there are times when a community good is necessary. And a global pandemic is one of them. But in a country like the United States, where we tend to be very individualistic, it's very hard for us to push those community good mandates. I think a lot of us were raised with the idea that we support our neighbors and we, you know, volunteer and we do things. But when it comes down to do this for yourself or do this for your community, as Americans, I think we tend to fall towards that for myself concept, like what's good for me. And if people don't think this vaccine is good for them, these mandates are really going to kind of get into our stubbornness and put our backs up. And I think once somebody makes their decision and they still get push, I think we as public health professionals are digging ourselves a hole where the more we try to push at them, the less they are going to trust us. Mm-hmm. And so a major con for me is that I don't think that we are helping ourselves by trying to push this anti-vaccination group.
Right, right. Well, what has your experience been as a health professional? Have you seen anything like this before?
I have not personally seen anything like this, but I do remember when I was kind of towards the end of my doctoral studies, New York City tried to ban large sugary beverages. I don't know if but it was the probably around like 2012-ish, and you know, public health Aaron was like, "Yay! You know, great! You know, we can tackle diabetes and we can push against the obesity epidemic." But pop loving Aaron was like, "They can't tell me what to drink." Mm-hmm. So it was one of the times where I was really seeing kind of the push and pull of this is great for the community. And there was a lot of support amongst the community in New York City for Michael Bloomberg's soda ban. And it wasn't a complete ban on sodas. It was, you know, just the size of soda that you could sell. And so there was a lot of public health support for that. But at the same time, it was very much like, who are you to tell me how much soda I can drink?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison that really sort of highlights maybe what is really going on here with the freedom of choice and not wanting to have to do something you don't want to have to do. Do you think that there are some folks that are just waiting for this to be off of emergency use authorization and maybe they're just hesitant? Because, I mean, I'll say when I saw that when I went to get my vaccine, I was a little taken aback. I was like, oh, what is this warning sign? And then, mm-hmm. you know, I'm just curious, like, if that is removed, if more people would be likely to take it.
I don't think it's a huge group of people that are waiting for it to not be emergency authorization, or I don't specifically know that that's the what they're saying. There are a lot of people who say they're waiting, but I don't necessarily know what they think they're waiting for, because what we've vaccinated over 300 million people at this point. And, you know, so that's a big chunk of the population has received a vaccine. And so, you know, people who say they're waiting, I think they're saying that they're waiting because they don't want to say, I don't want to get it, period. They just don't want to get it now, but they may not be able to put into words why they don't want to get it now. But I have heard a couple of people have said the emergency authorization is a stumbling block for them.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier just that, you know, when you keep pushing people to do something, they're less likely to want to do it. Do you think there are enough efforts being made to educate people on the safety and efficacy of the vaccine? Or is it just like too much for people to, like, it's overboard?
It's one of those things where public health professionals, I think sometimes we say, all we have to do is tell people and then they'll make the right choice. You know, all we have to do is tell them that they shouldn't eat so many calories and then they'll stop eating so many calories. But knowledge does not necessarily create action. And so when we look at kind of behavioral theories, there's a lot more that goes into it than just knowledge. And so I think the knowledge is there, but we have never dealt with the amount of misinformation specifically through social media and the echo chambers that people live in their social media worlds. And that is a very different game than what we've seen previously. And, you know, so how do we combat misinformation with the correct information, I think, is the struggle that most public health professionals are working under right now, because the knowledge is there. But when I tell people, you know, that mRNA vaccines are not new, they're like, well, no, of course they are. They just, you know, started working on it in 2020 when we got COVID. Well, no, they've been using, trying to get mRNA to work for vaccines for about 30 years now. And so it wasn't that mRNA vaccines popped out of nowhere. This research is decades long. And essentially all that happened was we threw a bunch of money at it, and they were finally able to make it work with that influx of money and people that shifted their attention towards those mRNA vaccines.
Right, right. And I wonder, you know, how responsible media outlets are for getting the message out that vaccines are safe. I mean, I guess it's I don't know. I guess it's like a double-edged sword. It's like you're trying to combat social media, and then you have like media outlets. There's just so much information.
It almost has to be done one-to-one. And so, you know, like confronting isn't a great word, but, you know, when you find somebody who says, I don't want to get vaccinated, well, why? And mm-hmm. then addressing their specific whys is one of the ways to do it. I think people don't necessarily think when they hear things on TV or the media or social media that it applies to them specifically. And so more than ever, I think we have to address personal whys they're not getting vaccinated in order to convince people. And I think there are a large chunk, more so than ever, of people who just won't do it. And I don't think that we're combating that.
Right, right. Well, Erin, thank you so much for joining us. I want to ask if you can stick around real quick after the break. We have a voicemail that we wanted to share with the audience, and I think a comment that we need your expertise on. So if you're able to stick around, that would be great. We'll be back after a quick break. I'm Miriam Soap, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. Erin Reynolds, Associate Professor of Health Services at the University of Southern Indiana, talking about the pros and cons of vaccine mandates. We have a listener voicemail from Dan. Let's take a listen.
My name is Dan. I'm a physician in Bloomington, Indiana. And I think that one of the reasons that you're having a hard time understanding why people are not getting exemptions, or why people are having a frustration with the exemptions, is because it's nearly impossible to get a medical exemption. The semantics of that are it's very, very deep. It has to do with there being no liability to the manufacturers, all that liability falling onto the doctors. If you look under the VAERS system and you look at the studies showing how many of them are actually reported as vaccine side effects, it's somewhere around less than 1% or less than 2% of them are. Anyway, point being with the COVID one, though, too, is that it's an experimental vaccine, and Nuremberg Code states that you cannot mandate an experimental medical treatment of any type, be it vaccine, medicine, or surgery, or otherwise. There are multiple problems with this issue. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
All right. Well, Erin, what are your thoughts?
I mean, he's not wrong, you know, that experimental drugs, experimental surgeries, experimental treatments cannot be mandated. And so it's one of the issues that we've been working under. And I think it's a reason a lot of organizations have held off with their requirements to do this. I know at USI, we were kind of watching what the other universities in Indiana would do and kind of taking cues from them. But, you know, I didn't ever see USI putting a mandate in place, because we, you know, want to make sure that we keep our students, you know, and so we didn't want to turn away students who weren't comfortable getting the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And a mandate would have been a turnoff for students. And so There are reasons why people aren't getting vaccinated. And, you know, of course, getting rid of the emergency authorization and going through the full approval process for the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines would help with some of that. Further research into the safety and efficacy. I mean, we are still only less than 2 years into these vaccines used in human populations. I think that would help people who are more medically knowledgeable, who have those types of reasons for not getting the vaccine. So there are things that will happen, I think, in the future. And I think mandates do push. And so they're pushing this too fast, I think, is a lot of people's opinions on the mandates.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you sticking around. And we'd love to chat with you again. Erin Reynolds, always a pleasure to have you on, Associate Professor of Health Services at the University of Southern Indiana. Well, now we're going to look into the legality of mandating vaccines like those for COVID-19. Is it legal? Can you mandate it? Can employers legally mandate vaccines? And what could be the repercussions if someone doesn't get the vaccine and their employer is saying they have to? Well, we're going to find out from our next guest. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us now is Amy Adelaide, partner and chair of labor and employment practice group at Krieg DeWalt. Welcome, Amy. Let's get straight to this. Can employers legally require employees and staff to get a vaccine?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on. If only the question were so simple, right? There wouldn't be a need for multiple discussions and articles and so forth on this topic. As a general matter, subject to lots of additional considerations, yes, employers can mandate vaccinations, including the COVID-19 vaccine. As we've already heard today, there are some exceptions to that general rule that employers must think about. First of all, we have the obligations under federal law, which would be to provide reasons to employees under both Title VII of the Civil Rights Act for religious reasons and under the Americans with Disabilities Act when an employee is unable to be vaccinated for a medical reason. In addition to those under federal law, you know, we also have additional limitations being put in place by various states, you know, that are entering this debate over whether employees can and or should be mandated to become vaccinated. We have additional things to think about, such as the difference in public and private employers, as well as collective bargaining agreements. And we have union workers and what those agreements provide. So the short answer, as a general matter, yes, has lots of additional considerations, as I said.
Mm-hmm. Does it matter if it's emergency use authorization when they're trying to mandate vaccines?
Well, we're certainly seeing that issue play out both in the media and discussions that are going on between groups in favor of mandates, as well as litigation beginning on that very issue. There's a federal court case that was filed in late February addressing that issue of emergency use and whether an employer can mandate a vaccine that's only approved for emergency use authorization. I think the interesting thing, several interesting things about that question of emergency use, however, is that, you know, since that time, we've had the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, which is the federal agency responsible for enforcement of the ADA, come out and say that federal employment laws don't prevent employers from requiring all employees to be vaccinated for COVID-19. There's no discussion in the EEOC's guidance that, hey, wait, you can't do that currently because we only have emergency use authorization. So certainly, at least from the EEOC's perspective, which would not be binding on a court, you know, they're not making any distinction between emergency use or full FDA approval. The other thing, you know, one additional thing that's interesting about the emergency use authorization debate is that under the applicable law, each individual must be informed of the option to accept or refuse administration, as well as the consequences and alternatives. So something that a lot of scholars are debating and legal minds are debating is, you know, does this emergency use authorization regulation mean that an employer can't then have a consequence of, you know, if you're not vaccinated, then your employment could be terminated? Most legal authorities that I've been reading are saying they don't believe that the emergency use authorization status of the COVID vaccinations means that employers cannot have their mandates.
Now, when it comes to exemptions. I know we heard from the listener earlier who said exemptions are kind of tricky and difficult to get to in the first place. Why is that?
Well, I mean, the exemptions, as I said, come under the come under Title VII. So if somebody for religious reasons requests an exemption from a vaccination mandate, you know, that person has to indicate to their employer that due to their sincerely held religious beliefs, they are unable to be vaccinated for COVID-19. I've gotten a lot of questions about, well, how do you know if someone's religious beliefs are sincerely held? You know, what does that mean? And can we challenge that as an employer? What the EEOC has said is that most of the time an employer, you know, needs to generally presume that those beliefs are sincerely held. Now, there could be situations when the employer might challenge whether those beliefs are sincerely held. And the EEOC itself has given some examples and said, you know, such that, you know, if that employee has acted in a manner that is inconsistent with their professed sincerely held religious beliefs, or, you know, is the timing of the request suspicious or something like that. But as a general rule, employers should assume that employees' religious beliefs are sincerely held. So that would be the religious exemption that somebody tries to, you know, request an accommodation. And the other being if someone has an underlying medical condition, a disability, that prevents them from being vaccinated. In that circumstance, most of the time, the employer is going to request medical proof, so a statement from that employee's healthcare provider stating that the employee is unable to be vaccinated for COVID-19, and here is the accommodation they're requesting. Now, the other thing to keep in mind about those exemptions is that they're not absolute, meaning that just because an employee requests an accommodation doesn't mean that it would be granted or that it would be a reasonable accommodation in all circumstances. So in thinking about, you know, your employee who says, I can't be vaccinated for these reasons, I need an accommodation, you know, what would those accommodations look like? Well, oftentimes those are things such as working from home, you know, working remotely, working a modified shift where maybe there's not as much interaction with other employees, wearing masks, social distancing, you know, those sorts of things. The ultimate question being, is that requested accommodation an effective accommodation? It may be that the employer determines that, you know, there is no accommodation we can provide here to this employee that doesn't still cause them to pose a direct threat to themselves or others in the workplace due to COVID-19. So those exceptions require you know, a case-by-case analysis by employers to analyze each employee's situation and determine whether there's an accommodation available or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a listener voicemail from Martin in Indianapolis who asks about the legality of mandates and possible loopholes. Let's take a listen.
My name is Martin Beach, calling from Indianapolis. Yeah, my question is for the legality of mandates, aren't there easy ways around it? Like, for example, in the case of IU, just don't call it a mandate and, you know, set a lab fee of $10 million. And if you don't want to pay it, you can volunteer your vaccine information.
All right. So what is your response to that?
So I guess sort of what he's getting to is, you know, the fact that some employers are offering incentives for employees to become vaccinated, you know, by strongly encouraging and providing incentives instead of saying you outright must be vaccinated. As you would expect, there are additional legal issues that come up with those incentives, such as, you know, if the employer themselves is administering the vaccines or hiring a third party to do so, the EEOC has said, well, those incentives that you're providing can't be so large that they are, in essence, coercing those employees to be vaccinated. Now, keeping in mind, as I said, that would only apply if the employer themselves is administering the vaccines or contracting with a third party to get those vaccines. But, you know, other issues that have come up is, you know, employers offering bonuses for employees to become vaccinated, telling them, you know, you can go be vaccinated wherever you choose to be, and here's the bonus that we'll pay to you. Other employers are offering paid time off to become vaccinated. You know, I think if we go to the extreme example offered by the listener, or, you know, the more extravagant example, that sounds pretty much like a mandate and would probably fall under that analysis.
Well, what is the, I guess, thing that employees could do if they don't want to get vaccinated, but then they get fired? Can they take their employer to court?
You know, they could certainly try. You know, we are certainly seeing some of these lawsuits start to be filed. There was a large hospital system in Texas that was sued due to its COVID-19 mandate. Actually, that one's already been dismissed by the courts, and the federal court in Texas said, yes, that hospital system could require its employees to be vaccinated, that there was no public policy claim or wrongful termination claim that the employees would have in that situation. So we are seeing these cases start to be filed. To date, I'm not aware of any that have been decided in favor of the employees or saying that the employers cannot mandate vaccinations. But I think we'll also continue to see, you know, some of those filed perhaps by public employees where there are additional legal considerations at play, including under the Constitution, as well as you know, the issues of these state laws, such as the Indiana passport law that would apply to state and local governments. So I think stay tuned for more to come on the litigation that will certainly ensue as more employers begin to issue mandates. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say that you know, we're just starting to see mandates, particularly outside of healthcare. You know, it wasn't surprising that we first started to hear about healthcare employers mandating vaccinations. Some have been doing so for months. I think what we're going to start to see more of and perhaps then see more legal challenges is employers outside of healthcare mandating vaccinations. And that's also what makes this very different from the past when we had flu vaccines mandated. Typically, that was only done by healthcare organizations, right? Like large hospital systems or hospitals at all or doctor's offices. And now what we're seeing with COVID-19 is additional types of industries, additional types of employers beginning to mandate COVID vaccinations. Which certainly is new.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's something that we have to just keep an eye on and wait and see how the discussion plays out. I want to thank you so much, Amy Adelaide, partner and chair of Labor and Employment Practice Group at Krieg DeWalt. Our producer is Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer. And actually filling in today is Chris. And if you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.